Regulations. First order of business is the approval of the previous committee meeting minutes, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion to approve?
Move.
Second.
Moved by Brandon, second by Holt. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Committee item number one, land water plan update. Mr. Cook, you may
Ricky. As you heard this morning, TPWD staff continues its efforts to simplify licensing options for hunters and anglers in Texas. Both commission and legislative action may be necessary to accomplish the reduction of licenses offered, and we'll continue to work on that and keep you informed and involved. TPWD staff has evidence that spotted sea trout on the lower Texas coast may require a different approach to conservation than the northern population. Scoping meetings have occurred over the last several months to solicit feedback on a regionalized regulatory approach. If approved, this proposal would represent the agency's first effort to regulate coastal waters on a regionalized basis. As of January 1st, 2007, all qualifying trail vehicles are required to display a current Texas off-highway vehicle decal when riding their vehicles on public land in Texas. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Item number two, 2007-2008 statewide hunting and fishing proclamation, permission to publish. Dr. Larry McKinney first.
If I can get in this chair without hanging my coat on it.
Yeah, that's a while.
Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, I'm Dr. Larry McKinney, I'm Director of Coastal Fisheries. Starting this process. As Mr. Cook noted in his notes, we have been scoping this issue since this summer, and we've made an effort to make sure that anyone that might be affected by this had a chance to hear about it. In fact, we've had about 10 scoping hearings altogether, and I've heard from some 246 people, so we've had a lot of input so far, and it's all been very valuable, which we appreciate. The issues that I'll be covering in the proposal include changes to regulations for sheephead, the diamondback terrapin, tarpon, spotted sea trout, and then some cleanup items, and then one additional item regarding a red snapper that has come up that I want to talk with you about. Take a look at the sheephead just very quickly. This fish comprises about 4% of all the recreational landings, and most of them are recreational. As you can see, there's not much of a commercial fishery for them, although there is some. The current bag and size limits are the same for recreational and commercial, except, of course, commercial have no daily bag limits, whereas the recreational anglers have a 5 fish per day limit. Our proposal that we brought to you earlier this fall was to increase the minimum size from 12 to 15 inches. This is something we want to do for all of our fish that are called recreational to make sure that they go through one full reproductive cycle before they are potentially removed from the fishery. But one of the things that we began to think about and talk about in after this proposal came forward is a concern that if we were to take our 12-inch minimum size limit now and jump it immediately to 15, that in fact we might close that fishery down for a year or so, take them out of there. So we didn't want to do that because the fishery is not in the trouble. We want to keep the opportunity there, but we want to move it in the right direction. So our solution would be to do this incrementally so that next year it would go to 13, then 14, and then 15, and let the fishery and the fishermen anglers move together and keep on track. So that's how we would propose moving forward with that proposal to public hearing.
Catch up with myself here.
Comments? There were not a lot of concerns with the proposal. There were some questions about the biology, of course, as we talked about that. A good comment, and one that we thought ourselves, of course, is the sheephead is a great fish for kids, and that's important. And there were some comments that we should only target commercial fisheries, but of course that wouldn't do as much good if most of the land into recreational. So that was kind of the bulk of those scoping comments. Texas and diamondback terrapins. This is a species that occurs up and down the coast. Not a lot of them. We're concerned, of course, about that population, as we talked to you about in the scoping meeting. We do see them in our crab traps and that type of thing. That's where we've encountered them mostly. When you look at some of the information about where they occur, you can get some indication from that. There is a growing market for these things across the country, and you can see there that you can see at $125 each, that's one price they can become quite valuable. So we don't, and there's no market for them or no industry for them here in Texas right now. We frankly don't want to see one get started and go down the road of going through endangered species and all that kind of business. So what we're going after public hearing, proposing to go after public hearing with is a no-take provision, except of course for the permanent non-game feeders. Now, Wildlife is going to be talking to you all right after this about the broader non-game program, and basically this is, we're going to put this out for public comment, but we want to work with them as they look at the broader issue and make sure it meshes. But we'll get them some comments on what people think about this during the public hearing, and we'll be of use to them, but we'll make sure that whatever we recommend to you will be meshed in with their bigger picture. Parking proposal. This is we did this course last year as well. The current size limit of 80 inches was put into place last year. The intent of that size and bag limit of one was to allow a potential state record fish to be returned, and in fact one was, as we knew at Expo. And so in order to keep up with that, we'd have to move that minimum size length up to 90 inches. We had quite a lot of comments on this proposal, but one that we did hear quite a bit about is, why shouldn't we just go to a catch and release fishery altogether? And frankly, I have a lot of sympathy for that. I think there's some support for it. And so I want to make sure when we go out on public for public comment, I want to bring that up and make that mention that we will be looking at that and get some input. My concern is that most of our scoping hearings so far have been in the lower coast in relation to the spotted sea trout. And there's a significant fishery up in Gallatin, so I just want to make sure that before we sort of propose out like that everyone has a chance to say their piece and give us their input. But if we don't come back with it this time, we will probably come back next year and take a look at it, make sure it's fully scoped, and everyone has a chance to have some input on it. But
so catch and release fishery is not an option in the scoping.
Okay.
Catch and release with no bag on standing.
Can be if we get enough public comments, we can do that.
What's Florida?
I should know that, but I don't.
Because I've been tarpon fishing there, and I've never heard of anybody killing a tarpon there.
I don't know what the rules are, but typically they don't. And I'll find out.
Somebody's shaking their head back there. I don't know
if it's official or not. I know unofficially, very seldom.
If it's a record, they just take a picture and tape it, and that's it.
I'm pretty sure it's a linked girth thing there. The only place I know where they kill them anymore, I still have a few tournaments, it's been some Louisiana tournaments that they still do that, require that. Most of the tournaments are that. I'll find out for you and get you that. Should know that. All right, let's move to the main and spotted sea trout. I won't spend much time over this with you last time, but if you have any questions, I certainly will be glad to answer them. Just to make a point in relation to some comments about the scope, meaning one of our concerns is, of course, is that typically our gill net catches for spotted sea trout in Laguna Madre have been 2-3 times that of anywhere else on the coast, but they, as you can see from the graph, they've steadily been going down, and for the first time in 2006 this year, they have dropped below the coastwide average, and of course that's the concern that we're talking about. What can we do to return that population to where it probably should be for the lower laguna? This is the one that certainly has our attention from a biological perspective. This is a spawning stock biomass. This is just the weight of reproductively viable females in the population, which is key to recruitment and recovery from catastrophic conditions and so forth, and you can see it is headed down precipitously. This is certainly on my mind right now. We've been looking at some long-range weather forecasts, and right now, in the long-range forecast, within 2 weeks, not this weekend but next, there's a high probability of a Siberian cold front coming through here with predicted freezing temperatures down into the Yucatan. And it could be one of the worst. There are some predictions of a level of freeze, something like 1983, which was a disaster. So this whole discussion may be academic, unfortunately. If we have that, we may have a real serious deal. So that's in between these meetings, I've been working with my guys. We're getting everyone together to get set to do what we can on that type of thing to be ready for that. So it's a big concern for us, and we're looking down the road, hoping we're all wrong on that. This graphic, looking at the distribution of fish through length classes, size classes, and this one, of course, is a telling one where we take a look at where we're seeing the fish disappearing in the population. When you look at this graphic and we split it between 1985 to 2001 is one group, after 2002 to 2005 is the second group, primarily because we put some regulations into place at the end of 2000 to show there. If you take a look, you can look at the link classes from the 12 to 14 and 14 to 16, you can see that in the last 5 years or since 2002, we've actually seen more numbers or higher numbers of those that class of fish than the 15 years before. But when you get into the 18 to 20, it begins to shift and you see them beginning to disappear and have fewer than it was previously. Classically, you have to say, okay, what is taking 20-inch trout? And there's only one thing I can think of that does that, and that's us. So it's a strong indicator to us that fishing mortality is a real issue and that we can have an impact. And so that's the basis of looking at a proposed regulation. We looked at a number of scenarios, as I noted in our last briefing. We did look at the changing minimum size lengths up to 16, but we have opted against that because we didn't see much of an impact on the population model. So the range of options that we've looked at from a biological perspective has been from 7 to 3 fish, and the impacts of that, how they affect population, harvest, and so forth, are laid out on this chart. I would tell you from our biologist perspective, a number of our biologists are very, very much, this is something they look at very closely, of course. If you were managing this thing strictly in that level, they would probably say we should look at a 4 or a 3 fish bag. I would like to propose to go forward on a briefing with to reduce the current 10 fish bag to 5 and get public comment on that and see where we're going. One of the reasons that I feel comfortable with proposing this is that according to our models, and of course our models are very powerful because of the data that's in them, we'll be able to tell within the first 2 years if we're down the right path. Because as we look at that information, I can make sure I get the correct numbers here. We'll see about 50% of the benefits from this exercise within the first year and 80% within the second year for most of our fish. Now, the older fish, the bigger fish, will take a little longer. We'll see about 20% of the benefits in the first year, about 40% by the second. So in two to three years, we'll see if we're on the right track. And, of course, we look at it every year, and we always will. But we'll see those benefits even with the five-bag limit. So that's the reason that I would propose to go to public hearing with that.
Barring a potential freeze.
Yes, sir. I'd like to say we may be back before you with something entirely different, but I hope not. As far as the proposal itself and boundaries and working with our law enforcement, the group that really, of course, knows that area down there really well, Gary Palmer and others, the northern boundary we would propose, which would be at what's called Marker 21. There's a wellhead channel across there. It makes it real easy for people to know where it is and without having a GPS, they'll see that. So that would be the northern boundary. We would also use the mouth of the two sets of jetties, Mansfield and Port Isabel, and of course include South Bay, the Roy, Colorado, and the Brownsville Ship Channel in that boundary. And within those boundaries, to try to make it as simple and straightforward as possible, basically, if you're within those boundaries in your boat or landing your boat on the shore, you should whatever the limit is set, that's what they have to have. If it's 5, then they can't have any more than 5. They can't. We won't get in a situation where they would say, oh, I've been out in the Gulf, I've come back in, I've caught my fish in the Gulf, so I can have 10 or whatever. No, if you're within the boundaries, you need to be 5 fish in your possession. That, to make that law enforcement issue, don't get in a situation like we've had in Sabine and other places where we have differential issues going on. That's what we would propose there. Of course, you might expect, we've had lots of comments, I'm sure you've heard them as well. And just a very brief summary of some of them here. Of course, there's concerns over biological need, and from that perspective, I think we're in an excellent position to lay out our scientific basis of this proposal. The data, we think, is very good and compelling. Certainly concerns over regionalization, because this is a whole new attack for us. Not necessarily for us, I shouldn't say that. In our commercial fisheries in Texas, we've been doing regional management forever, and of course other states use this approach too, so it's not new, but it's new for us. And so unfamiliarity and some concern over just that whole concept was certainly voiced. some concerns over how the impact on guided trips and really the economics types of things, of how would this affect economics here versus upper the rest of the state and that type of thing, all legitimate questions. Where we've seen some preferences, we've had a lot of comments saying five fish is something we think we could live with. We've heard other comments, three and four, of course, but the preponderance of comments that we've heard so far have been five. And of course, when we put a solid proposal out there for comments, that'll get people talking. So we'll hear, maybe hear something entirely different, but at this point, that's what's been on the table. I'm sorry, that was the last one. Any questions on that particular? I'll continue with the others. Okay. Some of the cleanup type items. We talked to you last time about that we have a rule in the books about harassment of fish, and in our book that basically talked about airboats when it was put in place back in the mid-80s. We wanted to just go ahead and make that apply to all vessels. That has raised some concerns about are we trying to do something in particular, aiming at something new, but in fact, no, we're not. This is just a technical fix for us to make sure that if a situation does occur, and really haven't seen any of those, talking to our law enforcement guys, haven't seen that necessarily, haven't taken haven't filed anything like that, but this would just make sure that if it ever happened, if all vessels, not just one particular vessel, they would look at. That's where we're on that.
What would harassment look like, as you said?
Well, I think it's hard. Law enforcement says, when I see it, I know it. That's the reality. I can't really give you much more of that, but the idea was, at the time, when it was passed, it was concerned about using airboats and hurt a little bit to come against the shore and hold them there. That's what the intent was. Not some concern to generation. What if I'm out there drifting up on fish in the middle of the bay under birds or something, and I drift through them, is that harassment? And yeah, it's not typically. We're not talking about that. I don't think that's there. It's never been used to this date, so. That's where it is.
Whatever it is, it looks the same from an airboat or a canoe.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I understand that part. Yeah.
Whatever it is. We didn't think we were raising it. Sorry.
Okay, Larry. Will we be allowed to go back to the sea trout issue?
Chairman Hubbard, whatever you wish.
I don't want to interrupt you.
No, this is however you want to do this.
I didn't know that you were leaving sea trout and
going on.
Go ahead and finish and then come back to
okay.
The discussion.
Yeah. All right. Yes, sir. Okay, all that. Another thing up item. Your last meeting, you adopted rules to regulate the offshore aquaculture along the coast. And one of the things that we failed to include there and didn't think about at the time, of course, is when you have these offshore facilities and they're raising fish and they're ready to harvest these fish and bring them ashore, they're still subject to normal bag limits if they're raising cobia or something like that. That, of course, won't work for an aquaculture outfit, so we got to make sure that they're legal. So we need to exempt them from bag limits so that when they do that commercial operation and land them, they won't violate any law. So we need to provide that for them. Very much of a cleanup item. In this, there's some inconsistency between statutory language, which talks about our issues as coastal boundary. We're talking about the boundary line between freshwater and saltwater, for example. We're talking about coastal. In our proclamation, we talk about the saltwater boundary. So to make it more straightforward and link those two things up for our law enforcement use, we just want to add the words coastal and saltwater just to make sure that people know that it's the same thing we're talking about. There's no differentiation there. An item that we didn't talk about last time, but the one that has come up, and this was something I talked with Colonel Flores about, and Bill Robinson that handles the fisheries issues, and this is something that we'd like to put on the table for scoping to assist them in dealing with red snapper. The Gulf Council recently, of course, passed a commercial provision that sets up a IFQ program for commercial snapper fishing throughout the Gulf, give them IFQs, and there's certain rules and regulations for it. Well, of course, our law enforcement folks can enforce federal laws. We have a joint memo to do it, but for example, if they arrested someone for a violation of a commercial federal rule here, it has to go to federal court. And if it's not a big enough case, the attorney general just doesn't have the resources to pursue it, and they're not going to. Whereas if we were to mirror and adopt those federal rules into state rules, then our game wardens would have the option to go to state court. on smaller cases or wherever and get more action. Therefore, we would have a chance, we would pursue more cases and make sure that that we're prosecuting violators of the commercial fisheries at the full extent possible. And it certainly makes sense, and we'd like to go out to public scoping with that proposal and see if we get the support, which I certainly think we would. And so that's that item. I believe, Mr. Chairman, that was the extent of its proposal.
Mr. Parker.
First of all, let's just stay with the red snapper thing. You partially covered my first item this morning.
Okay.
About firing and trying to investigate if we can create a license system for the party of people. I'm glad we covered that this morning. What about how can we? Is there any way that we can work with, or maybe we just have to leave the National Marine Fisheries Service and just paddle our own boat in our state waters, so that we don't come to a place where we have got to severely restrict the number of red snapper that an individual can keep. How can we address it?
And thank you for the opportunity. I think there are a number of things that we can do, and I just thought of one thing I was going to add to this, and I hit it in my pocket here. I'll bring it out in a second. The idea of putting these federal rules into place in the state will help that. That's a big plus there. Creating a licensing system to make it as easy as possible for those charter boat and headboat operators to do their business is a plus. There's also an opportunity to work within the Gulf Council. Now, right now, in fact, he would be up here with me, Robin Rikers, who is on our staff is chairman of the Gulf Council. And at this minute, they're debating the federal rules. It's not going too well from our perspective. The total allowable catch proposal is going down. It's like an auction. Every bird auction is getting lower and lower. It's more and more of concern. So that's one place, obviously, working there. One area in which we could and need to work as much as we can, we're trying to, but any help would be available, is that whatever the federal regulations come out with is to allow or try to, there's provisions that allow regions like Texas to, within the allowable allowable catch, to set our seasons and our limits that fit us as best as possible. So we want to encourage the National Marine Fisheries Service to give us those options, that whatever our allowable catch is, let us manage it, that it works best for our industry. So it helps our tourism and others that if they have a, we can set our seasons during the summer or winter or whenever we want to, as opposed to having to live with what something is worldwide. So working with that, we need to push that as much as we can. The other is, right now we have a different season. We have a 4-bag, a 15-inch bag and size limit for red snapper in state waters, in which will be in federal waters, it will probably be 2 fish and 13. Our population, I think, can sustain those state regs. That will give, and we don't have a closed season where it says have a closed season. So I don't see any reason right now where we should change that, and we can leave our state waters open to give those folks an opportunity to do something there. There's been some proposal, I know, that should we drop our limit down to 13, at least to match the feds in that way, and there's some issues that I have to get my biologist and our moderators to look at. I just don't know yet. I need to make sure. Can give you some biological basis. I can't do that right now, but it's worth looking at. The other thing that you could go out to scoping with, and you have these too, and that is, and this is something that they're considering, and I think it would be very helpful, and that is to look at a regulation that requires you to use a certain thing. They may go to this and says, and this is one way that helps reducing hooking mortality. And I'm going to just pass these around if I can do it without sticking it.
I started mine around. So.
Drop them in your hand. I want to have a workman's comp claim here.
Yeah.
but this is something I'd like to add to that scoping list, too, that we put in effect not only the federal rules, but that we go to a required circle hook type of thing. And that might be a...
What is that?
achieve? I don't know what that
is. It helps reduce what we call gut hooking. J-hook, typically, would typically swallow them. They could swallow them, and you get these deep hooks that's in the gills and then to enter. The circle hooks, typically, as you'll see, as they're coming around, they typically hook in the side of the mouth or something like that.
Only the larger fish.
And so that might be helpful there. So I think that's where it's scoping. We got the fourth quarter. Take a look at it. So those are the things, Commissioner Parker, that I think we ought to be doing.
We can include this in our scoping meetings.
But if you all would like to report that, we would roll it in there along with those snapper rules to see what people think about it.
I'm glad to see that we're maybe heading the IFQ route. Could you summarize why you think IFQs are going to be a better regulatory mechanism for developing the animal population?
Right now, what we have had, until we've gotten the red snapper, for example, we have what's called a derby, and then basically there's a certain amount of poundage of fish, red snappers, you can take a total amount, and basically whoever gets there first gets it done. So it's in your best interest as a fisherman, commercial fisherman, to get out there and fish no matter what the situation is, weather or position, and take as much as you can, as quick as you can. With an IFQ, it really turns it more toward a market system, basically based on your historic fisheries background record, is that the allowable catch is allocated amongst all the users, and they'll have a limited entry. And basically, after that, you have a certain amount of poundage that's yours. You can go get it tomorrow, the next day, you can spread it out however you want to. You can sell that quota, you can get out of the business, you can do all types of things with it that not only probably makes more market sense, but certainly from a conservation standpoint, is a big issue that will help take this situation around where everyone's out there trying to get the same fish at the same time.
Mm-hmm. So, well, it avoids the overcapitalization issue like you have with the shrimp.
Exactly. It begins to take care of that issue.
And with his opening remarks about changing the laws to where it would become a violation that could be taken to the Texas state courts instead of the federal courts will give law enforcement and in fact the fishermen a bigger place at the table.
That's exactly right. Exactly. Also, so drive to you, for example, one option. Now, our headboat, our charter boat groups are not really sold there yet, but I think very strongly, for example, that if we get to the situation where we allocate the recreational fishery, that if we could get an allocation a snapper for those guys, then basically say, here's what you can take on red snappers in our party boat, and they can go wherever they want to. Yeah. They can set the season when it's best for their business, knowing that they'll have a certain amount anyway, rather than as we are now, it's still a seasonal basis. I think there's some pluses there that we could go down the road if we can bring some of that fairly.
Any other questions, Larry? How do you think? Next up,
just a moment. To the sea trout issue. Oh, I didn't get to ask some questions about that.
Larry, Philip, I don't know why, but I'm going to open it right here. I hadn't opened it. This is from the sea trout issue. I just think I'm not going to make any recommendations. I'm just saying that we need to be careful because this is not only a biological issue, but of course it is.
And I wish you boo. I got on the
I guess not what's in that box, otherwise he wouldn't be open.
I'm hoping so.
Well, yeah, I hope
really didn't help stuff. It's a little deal to a bunch of big people, but it's a big deal to a bunch of little people. And this is from the she's in a big check. Larry, this is from the Mansfield Chamber of Commerce. That they are concerned about sea trout.
It should be. And I think there's more than 900 letters there or
something like that. Because it's in the record.
And like I say, it's a very big deal to a bunch of little people who make their living down there in that area 12 months out of the year, taking care of our fishing community, our saltwater fishing community.
I've spoken with several of them, that's true. Thank you.
We're all in this for a long time, man. Not just a short time. Right. Yeah. They're in a lot of fishing.
Thank you, Mr.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. My name is Ken Kozowski with Inland Fisheries Division. And today I want to go over the freshwater fishing proposals that we wish to get your approval to take public hearings. First is on Lake Texoma. The current regulation there, we have a striped bass daily bag limit of 10, and there's no minimum length limit, but we only allow two fish over 20 inches there. The possession limit is also 10. This is all our possession limits are twice the statewide daily bag, which is 5, not the Texoma daily bag. There were some situations there where some anglers were confused by that limit, since it's sort of an anomaly to the rest of the state. And also Oklahoma has a little bit different possession limits. They have some little different definition of final destination, so theirs were different also. What we're proposing to do there is to change the possession limit for striped bass. It would be 20, which would be twice the Texoma daily bag limit. We don't believe that would have any minimal or no biological impact. There'd still be some differences with Oklahoma due to some structural differences. But we do think it would help clear up some of the confusion there among both the anglers and law enforcement staff from both states. We did discuss this with the Oklahoma fisheries officials and law enforcement officials, and we've agreed upon this proposal. Next, I'd like to discuss the legalization of bow fishing for catfish. If you recall, last year when we implemented that with a sort of a one-year time frame on it. It would expire at the end of August of the current license year. At that time, when we discussed that, the commission directed staff to try and collect some information on this activity. One couple of things that we were primarily doing, the game wardens were gaining information on when they saw bow anglers over the course of the summer into the fall. We also started a survey of bow anglers to get some information on their activities. One of the things that we did find that a lot of the activity is concentrated in the spring and the summer. Most of the game wardens contacts were in July of the year, and all that was prior to the change, September 1st. So we really haven't had much of an opportunity to evaluate what's happening after the regulation change. Because of that, we'd like to extend the change for another year and continue to monitor that activity and to see if we can obtain any more information on that. Also, we'd like to mention that in November we did discuss with you some changes for largemouth bass regulations, some 16-inch maximums. After we discussed those with staff and continued to look at those, we decided not to pursue any of those at this time. Staff will continue to look at monitor those populations to see if we could do any regulatory changes there that would help improve the angling quality on those reservoirs. That's all the proposals we have. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thanks, Ken. Any questions? Thanks. Mr. Munroder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, for the record, I'm Mike Berger, the Director of the Wildlife Division. And I'm here today to bring forward some proposals for changes to the wildlife part of the statewide proclamation. First item to consider today is a modification of the spring rebrand turkey hunting season that would offer better hunting opportunity to to hunters. As you can see on the slide, the season now runs from the first, from the Saturday closest to April the 1st, and runs for 44 days. And this map depicts what that season is now. 2 years ago, we simplified this season by merging the north zone and the south zone into a single zone and increased the season length by a week. In the process of monitoring and evaluating this new season, we have concluded that while the 44-day season length is fine, the hunting opportunity could be optimized by reinstituting the zones, the north and south zones, that would allow the South Texas zone to open earlier and the North Texas season to run later. So what our proposed zone is an earlier opening south zone beginning on the Saturday closest to March 18th and run for 44 consecutive days. This new zone would also include three counties in the southeast portion of that previously were the month of April only and limited to one gobbler. And we determined that there's a turkey population sufficient to sustain a longer season and a bigger bag limit. The bag limit in the south zone would remain at four turkeys, gobblers only. The new north zone would open later on the Saturday closest to April the 7th, and it also would run for 44 days. The bag limit in the north zone would be four turkeys, gobblers only. This idea was discussed with the Game Bird Advisory Committee, and they are all supportive of this proposal. The next item is some mule deer housekeeping. You'll recall that 2 years ago, we adopted rules to eliminate double tagging. Hunters are no longer required to use a tag off their hunting license if they are also utilizing one of the many permits that we offer, such as MLDPs, LAMPs, special drawn hunt permits on WMAs, etc. When we proposed those rules, we inadvertently failed to include the general antlerless mule deer permits. So this proposal would eliminate double tagging of antlerless mule deer taken under the authority of the general antlerless mule deer permits. Also, when we implemented the mule deer MLD program almost 2 years ago, we inadvertently failed to make provision for the archery mule deer season portion. So we would propose to make the MLD permits for mule deer valid also for the archery season with archery equipment only. Concerning archery deer, in our continuing dialogue with the archery hunting community, they have expressed a wish for additional hunting opportunity in what is now a five-day close period between the archery season and the general season. As you can see on the slide, the current archery season runs from the Saturday closest to September 30th for 30 consecutive days. So the proposal would change that to add 5 days, reading it would extend from the Saturday closest to September 30th for 35 consecutive days. And we believe this is a legitimate request and is not a resource issue. Regarding lesser prairie chicken, currently we have a few places where prairie chickens are hunted, and we require for those cooperators five habitat practices and a harvest recommendation not to exceed 5% of the population. The proposed change would give our field staff more flexibility to enroll additional landowners in the managed land lesser prairie chicken program. Most landowners interested in the program are conducting some lesser prairie chicken friendly practices on their properties, and therefore the requirement of five practices is thought to be a little too restrictive and could be reduced to three. And also because the lekking behavior of lesser prairie chickens and their large home ranges, they use habitat components that often extend to several land ownership. For example, the nesting and feeding areas may be on one property, while the lek or the booming ground may be on a nearby property of another landowner. So variability in land ownership sizes can make issuing permits challenging, especially when the birds depend on a small portion of their range for lek when we count them. So increasing the harvest recommendation to not exceed 10% would allow our biologists greater flexibility in issuing the permits for those few landowners who are allowing prairie chicken hunting. Again, this was discussed with the Game Bird Advisory Committee, and all but one member were supportive of this proposal. Next item has to do with javelina. We've been petitioned by a private landowner to allow hunting opportunity on javelinas in South Texas by increasing the bag limit, which is now at 2 animals per year. As you know, our aerial survey data from 1994 and 2004 indicate a generally declining population across the whole of South Texas. These surveys were conducted in conjunction with our aerial deer surveys, where we count deer, and we were also counting javelinas at the same time. This being said, we know, staff knows, there are some areas where javelina populations are stable and are increasing. And you won't be surprised to learn that these are the areas that have good habitat where it's being managed, where there's an abundance of succulent vegetation, and that habitat is well managed.
Excuse me. Have you given any thought to perhaps incorporating, as part of the global approach to managing lands, to maybe incorporate javelina, if we're in instances where there's an overabundance of javelina, just like we manage the deer, we could manage the javelina. You're running the survey anyway, and you're seeing them, your biologist is looking at them, so he could say, well, you know, in your case, you don't have any, or they have too many.
Some areas we have high densities.
Yes, just a thought.
We do have a number of properties, and as I indicated, our general surveys indicate that on a broad cross-section of South Texas, the population is variable from area to area. And on those areas, without increasing the bag limit everywhere, you know, I think it would be possible to work on a property-by-property basis where we have a wildlife management plan in place, mirroring our managed land deer program.
Right.
You have a management plan in place, you do population surveys, collect harvest data, and turn those in, and then our staff could make our biologists working with those landowners under a wildlife management plan could make a harvest recommendation on those properties.
To where you take a more global approach to managing your game based on the environment as compared to the habitat versus species specific.
Yes.
What do we do to move that forward?
If that's your wish, we could put together a proposal that would incorporate those things that we talked about. So we operate under a wildlife management plan, and the requirements would be population surveys, keeping harvest records, maybe doing some habitat practices that most landowners who would already have this are probably already doing for white-tailed deer anyway. That kind of information would help us to better understand the population dynamics of these critters across South Texas. So if that's your wish, we can put that out for public comment in that format.
Yeah, love to.
Do you accept that?
That'd be great.
That'd be good.
Okay. Work on that. Get back to us.
Okay. The next thing is a little cleanup here. We want to modify the current regulations on tagging and wildlife resource documents for deer or turkey that are processed at a cold storage or processing facility that is exempt from record book requirements. We want to require that a tag or a wildlife resource document accompany that game until it reaches a person's home or a cold storage or processing facility that is required to maintain a record book. Right now, if you process that deer beyond quarters in the field, you're not required to have a tag with it.
To transport.
This would allow law enforcement to ensure that it was a legally taken deer, and this would require that person to keep the tag with that meat until they reach the residence or a cold storage facility.
That's a rule, particularly with MLDPs, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Because currently you can harvest that animal and travel 15 miles or 20 miles on a public road before you get to a destination, a cold storage processing that you've nominated as the
well, it's on MLDs, when you're, as you know, when you're traveling directly from where you harvested the animal to where the permits are kept at a headquarters or facility.
It's an untagged animal.
It's an untagged animal, but that is allowed. Okay. The next one has to do with taxidermy tagging requirements, and currently the taxidermist is required to document the specimens that require to maintain the documentation for a 2-year period after the taxidermy work is complete. And staff is recommending that taxidermists maintain the documentation for 2 years after the specimens have been returned to the customer or sold to recover the cost of taxidermy. And that so that somebody may not come and pick up their animal or pick it up for a longer period of time. And the 2-year period is a statute of limitations, so this would just require that taxidermists to keep those records for 2 years after the animal is picked up or sold instead of 2 years from when the work is complete. And that concludes our recommendations, and I'll have to answer any other questions you have.
Thank you, Mike. Any other questions? Any other discussion on this item? All right. If there are no further questions or discussion, I will authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period.
Does that include the stuff about the evidence?
Yes, sir.
Oh, great. Okay.
Committee item number 3, status of the non-game permit program. Mr. Matt Wagner.
Good afternoon, Chairman and Commission. My name is Matt Wagner. I'm Program Director for Wildlife Diversity. The purpose of my briefing is to bring you up to date on what we know about the increasing demand for the collection and trade of non-game wildlife. In 1999, we established two non-game permits. The first is a non-game permit, or formerly known as a collector permit, required to possess more than 25 specimens or to sell. We have both a resident and a non-resident permit. We also have a dealer's permit required to both buy and then resell non-game, both a resident and a non-resident permit. Of these two permits, only the dealers are required to report to us on their annual activities. The collectors or the non-game permittees are required to keep a daily log. There are 42 taxa of non-game that are affected by this permit system. 5 frogs and toads, a salamander, 20 turtles, which really make up the bulk of the activity that we see today, 4 lizards, 10 snakes, and then 2 mammals. Now, these are figures that were reported to us by dealers over the last 3 years. If you pay attention to the top 3 turtles, these are commonly known as money turtles. These make up either the bulk of the volume of turtles that are collected and sold, or they render a lot of meat from their the size of the turtles. So if you look, you can see that the wild caught by dealers, that's 50 dealers reporting to us. Nearly 26,000 red-eared sliders being caught out of the wild, but then about 178,000+ that were acquired, either purchased from collectors or acquired even in some cases from other states. And you pay attention then to map turtles, only 3 that were reported wild caught, but nearly 28,000 purchased from 15 dealers. And you can see the counties as well, the number of counties that were reported to us. These are where these turtles were caught out of the wild. And then box turtles. And we have some concern about box turtles in terms of their limited numbers. 29 dealers reported to us from 24 counties collected from them.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Either I don't understand this, or those map turtles are highly prolific.
How did you start with three and get to 27 miles?
Well, what we have here, let me explain a little bit. The left-hand column is wild caught by dealer, and then
where do these dealers get the 27 miles?
They're purchasing them from others that are being, they're collecting.
Out of state?
There are some portion out of state, but it's that most of these numbers are from wild caught in Texas.
But by somebody's
lying about the wild caught
dealer.
So you got some people not licensed that are catching them.
There were only three that were reported by dealers themselves that collected. The nearly 28,000 were purchased by others that were, from others that were permitted, the collectors.
So that may have been a business for you, John. You start
getting the purchase. Let me ask the stupid question.
Yeah.
Are we not catching them because they're just not here in the state? Or are they here and they're just not reported? In other words, I can see where only three are being caught because they're not very prolific.
This is, again,
I understand that, but what I'm saying is it not prolific in the state?
There are four different taxa, and they are confined pretty much to particular watersheds. So they wouldn't be necessarily as common as some of these others, but if they're not catching them, they are working with others that are. So they're not catching them themselves. You know, local individuals that have a better knowledge of the area that would be permitted as collectors and then themselves as dealers.
Collectors.
Are there regulations on catching turtles? I mean, if I want to catch mad turtles, then I catch as many as I want.
As long as you are permitted, yes. There are no restrictions on the numbers at this time.
What do you mean permitted? I'm not a dealer.
You would, if you possessed more than 25 and you were selling any, you would be required to have a non-game collector.
Okay, I went back. I'd be a non-game collector.
Get you 18.
Right. I get an $18 and I catch all that turtle I want.
That's where it is right now.
Thousands of them if I want.
That's where it is right now.
Okay, that's my question. Okay. And then I can sell them to a dealer.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
In fact, you must sell them to a dealer.
I can't sell them myself. What? Explain that.
Unless you're from East Texas.
Well, the way the permit is written, if you are a collector, you are required, and you're going to sell, you need to sell to a dealer.
Okay.
And I can get David Sinclair to confirm that.
Okay.
Now, there are other animals involved. We have a couple of lizards. The one on the top is the round-tailed horned lizard. This is not the Texas horned lizard, not the one that's threatened, it's protected. But, for example, the marbled whip-tailed lizard, one county, 1,400 specimens coming from one county over a three-year period by those that are permitted as dealers. Now, western diamondback rattlesnake make up a large number. Most of these, or a lot of them, I should say, are part of the rattlesnake roundup business.
Sorry? How many of the rattlesnake? How many of the...
Well, some work has been done in New Mexico, and I'd like to identify Dr. Lee Fitzgerald with us from Texas A&M has done some work on this, and his figures indicate that 15% to 20% of all the diamondback rattlesnakes collected, this is New Mexico, ended up in a roundup. So it was a relatively small number. We don't know for sure in Texas what that figure would be. A lot of these end up either as meat or skins and novelty items. 146 bullfrogs you see there, but over 82,000 that were purchased. And even a trade in black-tailed prairie dogs. Now this is illegal now, I believe, because of some disease issues, but there's some collecting that's still going on. We want to follow up on that.
Now, over the last few months, we've had various meetings with the user groups, including 7 herpetological societies. We had a dealer meeting here in Austin. We had about 300 participants. As you can imagine, we had a wide range of interest, from those that are strictly in it from the commercial side to those that want to have a pet, and the scientific community as well. But everyone agrees that sustainability is the goal. But we lack the population data to properly manage all of these things. So we have one side of the equation, and that's what we know about the harvest. So what we know is that our annual reporting is being improved. We have a growing demand for unique pets and turtle meat in particular. We believe we have increased pressure from out-of-state collectors. For example, box turtles have been prohibited from collection in Louisiana and Oklahoma and Arkansas, I understand, but not New Mexico. But there could be increased pressure from out-of-state collectors. And there's been concern about our turtles, box turtles in particular, diamondback terrapin, which was mentioned in the state line, map turtles, and possibly some other freshwater turtles. But we know that there's at least a couple of dozen species, mostly snakes and turtles, that are also being commercially collected we have no information on. They're not required a permit is not required to collect and sell them. So we're looking at that.
What are those?
Well, mostly snakes. There are a number of venomous snakes now that are popular. Trans-Texas copperhead. We have a list of one of our wardens in Harris County, John Rayo, has been interested in this and been going around various pet stores and keeping records for us. And we have that list. We can certainly provide it to you. So, and considerations as we move forward would be to first enforce the current rules that we have, including the reporting, to consider a ban on the commercial collection of box turtles, map turtles, and diamondback terrapin. And this is really due to their unique life history, including a slow reproductive rate and restricted range in some cases, like map turtles and diamondback terrapin. We also want to consider including additional species on the list requiring the non-game permit, and then to possibly convert the entire list to a white list, whereby everything that was not on that list would be prohibited from collection. We've also experimented or explored the idea of a breeder's permit. A lot of individuals are collecting and breeding these animals in captivity, and it could possibly be that instead of having a dealer permit, we could move to a turtle breeder permit, for example. That's something that we need to look into. And then lastly, we think that maybe 25 might be a little high for people to possess these as pets. So we may consider lowering that possession limit. So those are the things that we're considering as we move forward. And in April, we hope to bring you some specific proposals that for you to deliberate on.
Gentlemen, I'd just like to add, we just a very few years ago, we basically had no information. We finally got a permit for collectors and dealers. We've been collecting information. It's difficult. The guys have done a great job of trying to work with that information. I will tell you that, just kind of reflecting back, that the interest in these species is 10 times higher than it was 5 years ago. The utilization of some of these species for meat in the Orient and in Asia is 100 times what it was 5 years ago. We have very liberal rules as opposed to most states. So we are feeling some of the pressure that's being shifted from other states to Texas. You know, many of these species are fine. Many of these species have the protection, the added protection of their habitat, their home range being on private land, where access is controlled and managed. And yet, many of these species are associated with public waterways and those kind of things that allow immediate access, and highways, highway rights of ways, which you're going to hear some more about that kind of discussion. So, I appreciate you. You know, we wanted to brief you. I asked the guys here a few months ago. I said, look, we're not in an alarm situation. We're not in a crisis situation, we don't think. But we'd like to smooth this out some. We'd like to tighten this up some. We'd like to get better information. And we'd like to be sure that we can say to you and to the people of Texas who brought us by the that stack that Commissioner Parker pulled out of his box while ago is small compared to the feedback that we're getting about concerns about some of these species. So hopefully we'll be back to you, and any guidance that you have, any suggestions you're feeling about this, we would appreciate. That's why we're here today.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Could you invite Dr. Fitzgerald?
Yes. Lee, would you come up, please?
Oh, go ahead and announce yourself.
My name is Lee Fitzgerald. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Wildlife and Fishery Sciences at Texas A&M. I'm a herpetologist.
I would like for you to just give us maybe your personal and corporate of your colleagues' views about what we are discussing here today, and where we are, where it's headed, in your opinion, about that.
Okay. There is broad consensus in the scientific community, especially among experts that understand a lot about reptiles and amphibians, that the worldwide demand for reptiles and amphibians, for pets and for meat, has been increasing, and it seems like there's no end in sight of how much it's going to increase. It's really well known without argument among experts that there is a worldwide crisis in turtles. In Southeast Asia, for example, there are basically no turtles. One turtle is worth, depending on the species, can be worth as much as 1 year's salary to a person living in the countryside. This has created a large sucking sound from places that have loose regulations. And these trades in wildlife that are unregulated, that are, we call clandestine trades, are extremely difficult to understand because until you start monitoring them, it's impossible to get hard information that you can make scientifically defensible arguments with. And so that's what Dr. Wagner's problem is, and why some of the data seem a little bit vague, is because it's so hard to get data without a good monitoring system in place. Now, the reason that this is a concern is because we talk about turtles in Texas being harvested. Well, we're talking about 22 or so species, and the species collectively are at the extreme end of a natural history that makes it very difficult for them to sustain harvest in the wild. Many of our native species of turtles take more than 10 years to reach sexual maturity, and when they start reproducing, of course, most of their offspring die. They have a high juvenile mortality rate. And on top of that, it's very easy to go to an area and fish out all the turtles in a pond or in the reach of the stream. So sustainability is the goal, but wildlife management for species that have the biology like turtles do is going to require some careful management. Unregulated exploitation and turtles are just not compatible. We can't take it.
About the regulation excess of these species. What do you think personally about the regulations in Texas?
I think it's a real good start. We were talking earlier today, and in my opinion, I think these are really positive steps and good steps. Nobody expects to start out flying a 747, you know, without learning an assessment. And this is a good, you know, very good step. You know, there's species like box turtles that, you know, lay 3 or 4 eggs maybe every other year or every third year. This is a no-brainer. You know, box turtles are going to be in trouble if we don't protect them. And lots and lots of people care about turtles. People love turtles. It's important to public protection. In terms of all of these other myriad species of lizards and snakes and all that, we need to be collecting information on those so that we can come back to the future so you can make more informed decisions.
I'm pretty sure ahead of the presentation. The numbers I've read, and of course, once you're here, pretty alarming. I'm not a herpetologist, but know enough to know that it makes a lot of sense. They've been to China and walked through the public markets. It's staggering to see the sale of reptiles in the Chinese markets alone. You can see where this is going. My request would be two. One, if we come back, if we could put it in the context of goals, because we're supposed to set policy, let's set some policy. And two, I think we need to be realistic and recognize there's a market here, and we're not going to really make it a legal market we manage or a black market that's very hard to police. I think we have to think about regulatory tools to create a legal market we can manage, and I think the monitoring issue to have a goal of sustainability is a great goal, but it creates a huge question of how in the world you monitor and analyze that. And I think without the monitoring analysis, we're going to get caught in a how do you really know the answer debate, and you know, when we go to Sweetwater and talk about the roundup, how are we going to say you didn't do that snake side of it because they're in the county, so I think that's coming too. So to me, those things all need to be part of the package that we deal with here, but I think it's great to do it yourself.
Very good.
Any other questions?
And, my only other comment would be an enforcement issue, and I can see, Colonel, the burden of, would be on the game wardens. It seems to me that if it's a clandestine type market, either we legalize it and have it somehow surface, and then, and I hate to even say this, but we almost need people within your department that are kind of devoted on this. It seems to me it's a little monster that's out there.
And
that's going to be a game warden issue, I would assume.
I don't know whether this is at all applicable, but in theory, something like an IFQ creates a property right, gives an incentive for the people to hold the permits to protect it.
Sure.
And to report the guys who are
grabbing it, not just to exploit because they got a permit, which is what we have right now, actually.
We got the wrong incentive.
You make the offense, the payment for the offense high enough, right to start. You can set some examples.
And really, when you talk to these large volume dealers, they want to work with us. And,
sure.
And so do the large roundups. I mean, they there's all kinds of issues there. That's a whole separate issue. But we are talking to them, and they are fully engaged as we move forward. So
it's very much in their interest. We need to create a system that enfranchises them, but gives them the incentive to manage sustainably.
Any other questions?
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good show.
Thank you. Committee item number 4, scientific reader permit regulation. Mr. Clayton
Rich.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, for the record, my name is Clayton Wolf. I'm Big Game Program Director in the Wildlife Division. This afternoon, I have just two brief items. They are basically housekeeping measures of our scientific breeder rules. You may recall that less than a year ago, we proposed, and this commission adopted, some pretty sweeping changes to our scientific breeder regulations. We did a reorganization, a complete rewrite, and since that time we discovered a couple of errors, and these two proposals were simply to rectify those two errors. The first one is very simple. Section 65.611 requires that a person have a purchase permit for a deer transaction. You may recall that we actually recommended and did adopt the abolishment of purchase permits in lieu of transfer permits, so no such permit exists. So we simply propose to strike the word purchase And any permit valid for that specific transaction will be adequate in this section. Second one is just a little bit more complicated. The current rule requires that if someone wants to transfer deer for temporary purposes to someone else, they can do that for breeding or hunting purposes, but the rule currently restricts that to scientific breeders only. This is oversight on our part because previously we have allowed non-scientific breeders to take in possession fawns for nursing purposes. It was not our intent to change that. This was simply an error on our part. So we would propose, the proposed remedy is that if someone wants, if a breeder wants to transfer a legally possessed deer, they could transfer them to or from scientific breeders for breeding purposes, or to or from another person on a temporary basis for nursing purposes. Number two, the item number two basically would not be restricted simply to scientific breeders. We had seven comment on this proposal, four in support, and three in opposition. And that concludes my presentation. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Anything substantive in the opposition?
No, then of course the support came from Texas Deer Association and breeders. The opposition actually wasn't specific to these rules. It was more a philosophical opposition to holding deer in captivity.
All right, any other discussion by the commission? If there are no further questions or discussion, we'll place this item on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Thank you.
Well, you got all easy then.
Yeah. Any item number five, could the species list definitions harmful or potentially harmful exotic fish, shellfish, and aquatic plant rules? Mr. Cody Gray, please make a presentation.
I'm Ann Bright, General Counsel, and the reason I'm here is there's a legal issue that caused this to come back to you, and I just wanted to kind of let you know where we were on that. These rules were actually initially set for adoption in August, and one of the requirements under the government code, whenever we adopt a rule, in the proposed rulemaking, we have to include information about the impact of that rule on small business. When we initially proposed those rules, we did not include that because we did not believe there was any impact on a small business. In August, the gentleman showed up to testify, and he said that his small business was going to be impacted by these rules. As a result, what we did is we separated out those sections that had the small business impact, and we re-proposed those to address that small business impact. The remainder of the rules have been adopted, and that's why we're here today.
Thank you.
Chairman, committee members, my name is Jody Gray with Anlin Fisheries Division. At the August 24th, 2006 commission meeting, the commission was asked to adopt proposed amendments to the harmful, potentially harmful exotic fish, shellfish, and aquatic plant rules, which included adding round goby, two Chinese carp, Chinese perches, and non-native tempered basses to the prohibited fish list, prohibiting all southern hemisphere crayfish and all species of giant ramshorn and apple snail, except one that's prevalent in the pet trade, and adding eight species of plants to the prohibited plant list. Other reclassifications and rule clarifications were also included. As a result of the comments concerning the Australian red claw crayfish, included in the proposed amendments were rules to allow the possession, propagation, sale, and transport of live Australian red claw crayfish, provided applicants obtained an exotic species permit from the department. Although we received no comment on the re-proposed rules, staff has had correspondence with an Australian Red Claw producer who may wish to comment at tomorrow's meeting. And we have to answer any questions.
Any questions or discussion? Okay. If there are no other questions or discussion, I'll place this item on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Thank you, Jody. This committee is completed with business.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Crickley. Mr. Cook, is there any other business to come before you?
Sure, I believe so. We've got a 6:30 tonight at Bullock or Lydia, and look forward to that. Thank you, sir.
I want to thank staff for their excellent presentation as usual, and this meeting is adjourned.